informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Today, a place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, welcome everyone here on the fourth day of February in the year of 2022. And thanks for that very neat introduction, Giuseppe. I always appreciate that. And today we are going to discuss a subject which you had to have seen in the media, regardless of where you look, for the past, 4 or 5 years now, as our good friend Blackbird9 likes to say, Russia, Russia, Russia. So we are fortunate enough today to have with us from the mother country, as it's referred to at times, Paul English. Paul, how are you today, sir?
I'm slightly chilled because it's a cold day, but I feel quite bright and breezy. It's been a good week, I think. Yeah, it's been a very good week, actually. I've had a very good week. And, all started off, last Saturday. I was kindly invited onto, Operation Scorpio. That went well. And then you did a cracking show last Sunday. I caught that, I think only yesterday, with Dale and with, Blackbird9. That was some really good stuff. I particularly like Frederick's comment towards the end where he says, I've got to take so many notes. There's so many good, so much good stuff coming out, because there was a real, fantastic sort of interchange between the three of you over those last 35, 40 minutes. Not that the rest of the show was bad, but it was particularly notable at the end. So good. And then, good things on the domestic front here, I think. And, all in all, you know, England's really happy again. There's a little bit of sarcasm in that, okay?
just a touch, right? Just a touch?
Yeah, just a touch.
Okay. Comparatively, I think we have a unique perspective here with you being in England and me here in the colonies, so to speak. Are you seeing that in your local media and in the media of Europe, are you seeing the same hype with Russia and the Ukraine that we're seeing in the U.S.?
I don't think so. I think it's there, but it's not as intense. We've had really weighty matters to concern ourselves with over here, like the Prime Minister going to a party without a mask on. This is very important stuff, you know.
And, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. But it's there. It's definitely there. I mean, I'm not, I guess, because I don't glean directly the British media. I mean, I was never a big newspaper reader anyway in the past. That's not how I would go about doing things. So I'm not really a consumer of their stuff much. But generally, it's obviously your neck of the woods that's going to do it because they want to use you and your lads to send them out there on another wild goose chase if they can organize it, you know. So I don't know whether the Brits will be involved, but you see, the numbers are all silly. I mean, the whole situation is it's a bogus theatrical event like most of the news stories we've been consuming for the past 20, 30 years and longer, you know.
Oh, in my view. I totally agree. Are you aware of the alleged phone call that took place between President Joe Biden and the Ukrainian President Zelensky?
I'd heard of it. I saw a little headline of it. Didn't jump in. Something about Biden offering to not put nuclear missiles in the Ukraine. Is that right? Or something like that? Or come and have a look. We haven't got any. Honest. You can trust us.
I thought that the thing that stood out to me, and if in fact what we are told is anywhere near correct, was that Biden in the phone call warned Zelensky that a Russian invasion is practically certain for the month of February. And he says, because right. The frozen ground makes it possible for tanks to pass through. And during right. That conversation, Zelensky says to Biden, well, you know, I think, Mr. Biden, that you should lower your tone because as far as we see it here, the Russian threat is still ambiguous. What do you read into that?
More media manure, really, Michael. You see, once I don't know quite where I'm supposed to start believing them. At what point in their narrative do I go, oh, yes, I think you might now be telling the truth? I personally find it very difficult to accept anything that they say as having much correlation with the truth. Because it seems to me, I mean, it's not just politicians on your everywhere, and also – more importantly, I think the powers behind them that are influencing and ultimately controlling these wasted human beings, as far as I'm concerned, they're using language not to create intelligent understanding amongst the electorate or whatever you want to call us. They're using language to create the very opposite. The whole purpose of their language, of course, is to disguise their true intentions and to create false perceptions all the time. I mean, who is it that's on the verbal warpath? Is it Russia? I don't have the impression that they are. I mean, you could then say, well, Paul, you wouldn't. The Russian press don't have a big presence in Britain. And no, why should they? But certainly I don't have that impression at all. I mean, if we were to stand back and look at it sort of even in just simple geographical terms, and I was on a show the other week where they said, oh, we're going to talk about the Ukraine. I think I might have told you. I thought, oh, I don't know very much about the Ukraine, other than that the Ukrainians gave all the German troops lots of flowers when they went in there in 1941 on the way through. But there's a lot to know about that little part of that world because it's really a fiefdom under Jewish control. And who owns the press in your neck of the woods? Maybe compatriots, okay? So there's that aspect that must be borne in mind. But as soon as you start forgetting that, I think, and thinking that these spokespeople are genuinely representing the interests of America in these events, I think you're lost because I don't think they are in the slightest. So, but obviously, yeah, Russia is being demonized, but it's been demonized for quite a while, hasn't it, now?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things, Paul, that I always run through my mind as a filter before I watch any or read any mainstream media sources in America is the quote by CIA Director William Casey in 1981 when he said, "We will know Our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my filter. So I think we're probably on the same page there.
But I know. I'm sort of even we're kind of talking about it almost like a language problem, which is, you know, if I cast my mind back to how I was, say, in my 30s, generally, I suppose I was consuming and believing most of the stuff that I read. Not that I was an avid newspaper reader. I would read books or research things that even back then is what I wanted to do. But it's a major problem. I'm going to run out of adjectives to describe how big a problem it is. So we better not start, but it is a serious problem. You have to continually, I think, almost like stick a pin in your leg to keep yourself awake. Don't get hypnotized by this stuff because it comes from every side, you know, the TV, the newspapers, the radio. Everybody's just saying, oh, it must be true because they're all saying this. Of course, little realizing most people that the spigot for this stuff is probably just one spigot that just goes out and gets spread around, you know, like filth everywhere. So it's difficult. And of course, Russia, why would they pick on Russia? Well, I think we know why they would pick on Russia. I think there's a lot of clarity about, I mean, Russia is basically it's a symbol in some regards of the complete uselessness of communism right now. I mean, that's one thing, which of course the people that organized and built communism, who are the same people right now that are in charge of sending American troops over there or wanting to, cajoling the public. It can't be something that they're too happy about. I don't know. Maybe they don't care, but of course, like nearly all their ideas are absolutely useless and don't work. And so here's Putin, who has taken a whole series of measures. And that's also difficult to know. I've got some stuff about him that's worth even just sort of throwing up on the wall and having a look at. But certainly in terms of what he's been doing and restructuring that country back in line with what you would say is the Orthodox Christian roots of the country, that basically invalidates their joke of a state, you know, from 1917 to 1990. Because it was a hellish joke as well, of course. So there's history there, isn't there? There's history. And as you well know, which has been echoed and reamplified back at us through different means. And and apart from which, of course, we've got this COVID nonsense going on as well. So that narrative has weakened seriously over the Christmas and early New Year. It certainly has here. We've got lots of media pundits and who are all for are now backtracking, trying to cover their backsides. Oh, I was never for, you know, but all their names are on a list. The trees have been selected and the rope is being made as I speak. No, it's not. I'm getting a bit carried away, but these are, you know, there's a lot of people doing that as well. So another distraction. I mean, another one, Michael. There'll be more on the way yet. We'll have quite a few this year, I'm sure.
Oh, I could not agree more. Paul, are you familiar with the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission in Ukraine?
I'm not, no. Excuse me, I'm not.
Well, most everything that they put out, and one of the things I try to do every day is usually starting at about 3 or 4 in the morning, is checking sources from a multitude of different sources, and then I try to somehow glean a little speck of truth from everything that I read. But one of the things that I believe that gives this special monitoring mission in Ukraine credit is the fact that they are totally ignored by the American media. So that, to me, is a positive sign. But
yes.
What I am seeing, and they were talking, I read their article, they were talking about the Russian deployment. And the Ukrainian Army and National Guard units, amounting to about 150,000 men, have been recently mobilized, and they are armed and trained and commanded by the United States and NATO military advisors and instructors.
Mm-hmm.
So what the hell are we doing involving ourselves in military maneuvers in a foreign country? And then, you know, we want to talk about every good red-blooded American conservative in this country wants to talk about the stolen election of 2020. but yet they fail to recognize the 2014 election, to where the United States unseated a duly elected president in Ukraine and replaced them with a administration of our choice.
Yes, they did. And someone, of course, who is sympathetic, wrapped up with all the oligarchs. I mean, effectively, you know, liberal democracy is basically the playground and produces oligarchs, which end up in charge of everything. So, you know, we saw that when the wall came down, the asset stripping of Russia during the 90s and into the early 2000s. And they've recovered well from that under Putin's leadership. Of that, there's no doubt. And I think, you know, the other, on a sort of the larger scale, if it is the larger scale, or certainly the backdrop, is the grand plan, you know, the great chessboard of coming to control and rule the whole world, you know, because it needs to be controlled and ruled by these people, according to themselves. And you'd have to say that Russia is running counter to the globalist liberal narrative, thankfully. And it's why, I mean, this is absolutely surreal. You know, I remember growing up as a teenager, you two no doubt, Russia was not viewed favorably, and rightly so, because it was a dunghole and it was not a good place. It was a ridiculous place because it was commie. And, you know, commies are morons, basically. There's no other, you know, I'm not even going to get started because, as I said, there's a long list of words that we can use. But it's an idiotic ideology, especially designed to purely appear to be the bogeyman against capitalism so they can get their, you know, dialectic going and all that kind of stuff. And so that's failed miserably. And yet during that time when we grew up, you know, we thought of it terribly. And now we have it reversed. Now we have a situation where we look at them as embodying or restoring aspects of nationalist pride, which I am pleased for them about. Whilst the shoes have been swapped around, now we are enduring the decay that comes with the modern form of communism, which is called liberal democracy or whatever tags you want to put on it. So it's been reversed. We live in reverse our world compared to the world I lived in as a teenager, and no doubt you too. There's one thing that's still consistent, which is the aggressor in this is the controlled United States, because it is controlled by forces that are not necessarily loyal to America, whatever you might think that is. Just as this country where I live was controlled very much and remains under the control of people whose interests and goals are not in line with the interests and goals of the actual people of the land. So, you know, that's... And well, here's Putin running counter to that.
I think so. I'm sorry, Paul. Didn't mean to step on you there, sir.
No, you didn't. You didn't at all.
One of the things that preparing for today's program, I happened to look back at an article I wrote in the year 2010, and I made the observation that the United States and Russia were two ships passing in the night. They were attempting to go where we were 50 years ago, and we're going to where they were 50 years ago.
It's an apt analogy. Yeah, it's apt. Absolutely right.
So one of the things, as I said, in doing the research, I looked at from 1991 to 2014 when we overthrew a democratically elected president in the Ukraine. From 1991 to 2014, according to the U.S. Congressional Research Service, so this is not, I didn't get this from the right-wing media, the U.S. provided the Ukraine with $4 billion in military assistance.
Yeah.
But then we added, and that was $2.5 billion after 2014, plus over $1 billion provided by the NATO Trust Fund. And that is only part of the military investments made by the major NATO powers in the Ukraine. Your country, Paul, for example, concluded various military agreements with Kiev, investing, among other things, £1.7 billion in the strengthening of Ukraine's naval capabilities. This program provided for the arming of Ukrainian ships with British missiles, the joint production of 8 fast missile launchers, and the construction of naval bases on the Black Sea and also of the Sea of Azov between Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia. And, of course, within that framework, Ukrainian military spending, which in 2014 was equivalent to 3% of their gross domestic product, has now increased to over 6%. So since 2014, there has seemed to be quite a bit of money funneled by NATO into the Ukraine once we control their government. And one of the things I found unusual was that, you go back and you listen to, some of the excerpts of some of the conversations with Victoria Nuland and her staff and what have you in 2014, where they spoke openly of overthrowing the Ukrainian government. And, of course, good old Bubas in America doesn't really care because there's football on Sunday. But another thing that really troubled me is, in addition to the United States NATO military investments in the Ukraine, there is another $10 billion being implemented by Eric Prince, who is founder of the private U.S. military company called Blackwater, which has renamed itself and called itself now Academy. And they have been supplying mercenaries to the CIA, the Pentagon, and the State Department for covert operations, earning billions of dollars of taxpayer money. Prince's plan, which was revealed in an investigation in Europe, is to create a private army in the Ukraine through a partnership between the Lancaster Six Company, with which Prince has supplied mercenaries in the Middle East and Africa, and the main Ukrainian intelligence office controlled by the CIA. Do you see anything here that would cause you to be concerned, sir?
No, I'm very happy with all of that. I feel the world is in safe hands. I mean, the interesting thing about the money, the billions, the figures that are thrown around, and what does it all mean? One question, of course, that's never asked is, where did all that money come from? Okay, so, the actual answer is it's made up. So all it's basically sort of a robbing a Peter to pay Paul type situation where there's one party in charge of all the process. So it's called investment, is it? I mean, the $4 billion that you mentioned, you won't see a penny of that back. You weren't meant to. You'll be made to pay for it, though. Part of this process of paying for not just for their mistakes, but also their plans, which have got a hold of effectively a bank in such a way, or a banking system, that they can generate these sums of money to do what they like, and then you pick up the tab. This is always the way, because they'll invoke, they'll use this word, we Americans. These people are not Americans. They're not. And they've got no, couldn't care less about America. And this is a massive problem in terms of being able to separate the wheat from the chaff with regards to the truth and everything. Because the mainstream media, of course, tell a story which uses the word we and our country and things like this. None of these terms mean anything anymore because everything's jumbled up. It's all lost. The energy of the people's been dissipated and gone away. And when you have aliens, which is effectively what it is, outside of your own race, in charge of the power centers of your country, particularly banking, particularly the law, particularly the media, and education, and government too, and you've definitely got that. Oh, and we've got that problem too, right? And so is Australia. And so is New Zealand and Canada and the whole of Western Northern Europe. When you've got that problem, it's very difficult to know just who we means anymore because it didn't mean much. So the mainstream media put out this narrative that we are supposed to swallow down because we are faced by a threat from Russia. Are we? I don't think we are. I think the people in charge of these nations are the ones that have undue influence over them. through those power centers that I was just mentioning, and others, of course, they have a plan. And so it's important that we all believe that we're a we when that's important. And it's also very important to them that we get really clear that we're not a we anymore. In other words, when there's profits to be had, they'll have those. And when there's a cost to be paid, we'll pay that. And that's a kind of basic principle that's been running for a long time, irrespective of who's been in charge. So, you know, I've kind of gone off a bit off the point, but I always end up sort of stepping back with these newspaper reports because the figures are bandied about, you know, we're trillions in debt. What does that actually mean? Who's we? I'm not in debt. Or am I? So, you know, people are making a claim on my future productivity to pay off a bill that's got nothing to do with me. And why do they want to go there? There's only one reason to go there, which is to extend the power base so that they can encircle Russia, so that they can weaken it slowly but surely, and so that they can try and port liberal democracy back into Russia, which at the moment they're not going to be able to do because Putin won't have any of it. He won't have that. And the Russian people don't want it. So, you know, they're going back to being the Russians of the root to some degree. Not all of them, but you know, many of them. And you have to, from a distance, I don't know, I've never been. I'm not an expert, Michael, so I can only give it, you know, second and third hand from a distance, really looking at it. But from what I understand, the whole of the sort of Christian ethos has been put back into the education system. I think that's a good thing. Yes, it won't be perfect. Yes, it will have its flaws. Yes, there will be its critics. But in comparison to what they had to endure, and what the rest of the world is enduring in the absence of that, I think they're batting on a good wicket, if you see what I'm saying. They're going well.
Oh, well stated. Paul, one of the things, and I'm probably going to butcher some names here because I'm very conversant in Russian, but Russia has... no, I'm sorry. But
Last.
Lasted. But yeah. A Russian defense minister, and of course this wasn't in the U.S. or in the British press at all, but Russian defense minister Shoigu, S-H-O-I-G-U, so folks, if you know how to pronounce that, I don't, but I made an attempt. He denounced and made a statement which I totally believe, having some kind of inside information from time to time. And he said that in the Donetsk area region of the Ukraine, there are, and I quote, private U.S. military companies that are preparing a provocation with the use of unknown chemicals, unquote. Is that a portent of the future, Paul? Are we about to see a false flag attack, if it in fact occurs, where the U.S., something like, you know, the Katyn Forest deal in Poland in 1940. Is this where we have people employ a chemical attack on Russia and, I mean, on the Ukraine and blame it on Russia?
Yeah, I'm just going to pick you up, though, on that use of the word we, Michael. because it ain't you. No, it's difficult. You see, it's difficult. I'm trying to sort of keep my radar going all the time. You see, it's not we. It's something else that's at play, that's been at play for a long time. I don't know. I can't answer that, really. I guess we would. Well, actually, you and I would see, and others as well. But, you know, what's the history of modern warfare? It's false flags aplenty, and it's lies aplenty. In fact, it can't, you know, war can't be brought about without lying. It's the fruit of lies, always. And, which is why it's such a mess and why it won't benefit us. I mean, the idea that America is going to buy into its own idea that it's a super military power has got a lot of question marks against it. And, because things have not gone well, for the American military for a long time, because in most part it's intended for things to not go well for your military, because I would suggest yet again that our people are not in charge of our military. You're not in charge of it. There's all this other, the whole of the sort of command systems of practically everything has been chewed out by this other view. People are carrying it, harboring it. I mean, you know, the commies in the 50s It all turned out that there really were Reds under every bed. And I know it's comic book to sort of use these phrases, but it's true. You know, it's absolutely true. They work through subversion and demoralization to demoralize. And a great way to demoralize, of course, is to lie in the press and keep doing these things. So whether they are feeling that, yes, we will brag about having a chemical attack or not. I mean, to some degree as well, you see, the damage is done, or a huge amount of damage is done, I feel, purely by putting the story out in the first place. Everybody gets to imagining the horror of this kind of stuff and what's going to go on. And yet it's more than just saber rattling, because there's a whole sort of communication strategy around this to bring things to a head, possibly. Yeah, possibly. Why would there be a requirement to do this? Well, I think, you know, the Ukraine is really little more than a Jewish fiefdom. It's run by them. As we said, Newland and her husband are out there doing things. And, you know, she's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but they don't need to be, because they're going around threatening people and doing things and implying stuff. And we're going to put some missiles here. Why? What for? Because Ukraine's threatened. No, it isn't. It just isn't. Well, and of course, Russia don't want a war with the Ukraine. They don't want one at all. No one wants a war with anybody, but someone somewhere is going to try and make one happen, possibly. So, I mean, Michael, I just can't see. I don't have a crystal ball in my future. I mean, I can't see into, no, actually, that's true. I'm not going to be getting a crystal ball, and I can't look into one right now. It's just, it's beyond me to actually foresee all this kind of stuff. But, and it's a concern, because if it does kick off, obviously it will be, American infantrymen dying or whatever, and Russians dying. And if it ends up as a skirmish, it'll be a bit like Chechnya. It'll just roll on for donkey's years. It's ridiculous. I mean, and Ukraine is economically like a gutted basket case. All the bright people leave. The ones with the height, they all leave. And they don't stay. And yet, it used to be the breadbasket of Europe, the Ukraine. Fantastic place, you know? So I would simply suggest that it's because the Ukrainians are not in charge of the Ukraine.
Obviously.
And, you know, they're not the only country that where the people are in that situation. But because of its geographical proximity to Russia, which is effectively saying, hey, your globalist ideas, we tried all that, and it don't work. I mean, you know, but no one's talking about that. You know, yeah, we were the big test case. They slaughtered 60, 70 million of us to try and make it work, and it's a joke. And so we speak from experience. It's in their blood. This is rubbish. It's complete rubbish. And as I said, you know, maybe that's part of it. You know, we are talking about a vengeful people, after all. Might not like that too much.
Well, Paul, what I was thinking of, and I bring these historical things into play, are you familiar with under the Kennedy administration what the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary McNamara brought before John Fitzgerald Kennedy, which was called Operation Northwoods? Are you familiar with that to any extent?
I am. Yeah, I read that a few years ago. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I keep thinking about that. I keep thinking about that scenario, and I remember the old, you know, when we first had Monday Night Football in America, we had a commentator on there named Dandy Don Meredith, and I always think of something he kept saying over and over and over again. And it would be a play in the game which would be successful, and Meredith would say, well, keep running that damn thing till they stop it. Well, the American Intelligence Organization, which is a, you know, oxymoron, they keep running these same type Operation Northwood scenarios because the American people keep buying into them. And the thing that really troubles me here is that if they were to use chemical weapons, let's say in against Ukrainian civilians in Donbass, and then immediately claim in the American press and probably in the European press too that the Russians of Donetsk and Lugansk were responsible for this, and all it would take would be some talking plastic heads on CNN and BBC, and then they would say that then those then would be attacked by the Ukrainian forces already deployed in the region to force Russia to intervene militarily in their defense. So I see a chess game going on here already, and I have to admit that that is concerning. And, you know, then ready to slaughter all of the Russians in the Donbass is the Azov Battalion, and which has been promoted to a special forces regiment, which is entirely trained and armed by the U.S. and NATO. Are you familiar with this Azov Battalion, Paul?
No, I'm not. No.
Well, it is, and this was created by Victoria Nuland in 2014, and the man she brought in, and again, I'm going to have a problem with the pronunciation of these Russian names, but she brought in Andrei Beletsky to command the Azov Battalion. Now, ironically, the Azovs are neo-Nazis. And they have recruited neo-Nazis from all over Europe. And they pattern themselves after the SS unit Das Reich.
But the thing Michael. I like the sound of them already. My kind of people.
But the thing that's concerning me, Paul, the thing that's concerning me about this is, where is the Azov Battalion getting the majority of its money from the state of Israel?
No. Well, there's one for the books. I'm shocked and surprised. Good gravy.
I'm sure you are, sir. Take a few minutes.
I never thought they had their hands in other people's affairs and were up to things like that. Thought they were too busy on the kibbutz being peaceful. Well, you learn something new every day, don't you? I think, of course. Well, of course, who called them neo-Nazis as well? That was my point, right? You see, these terms are just rolled out. Trigger words. You were talking about, just going back to this thing about Northwoods, right? That they will keep on running a play until the other side detects it. Well, it's not detected through amassing lots of information, because lots of information has been around on these things for a long time anyway. It seems to me, you know, when you're looking at it, you could have got hold of this stuff, or somebody could. It's something to do with a kind of bemused, semi-hypnotized, docile state. People don't have an attitude about their own life, and they're continually acquiescing to authority structures, and they do it in the form of the media. And so if the media can get away with a thing 1 month and find it still works 3 months, why not? It's like sales techniques. They didn't see it then. Oh, they can't see it. They're never going to see it, because they're not actually interested in inquiring about the nature of their own lives on some level. Now, that's a bit harsh, because, you know, some people, it's just slow. And when you're young, you're a sucker. Easy. You don't realize you are, because you're so happy, but you can be. And they're obviously taking advantage of that. So, I mean, where is the warfare really taking place? Obviously, men, we have a tradition of talking about things like tanks, aeroplanes, bombs, missiles, and things like that, because those are the machinery, the materialistic aspects of war. But of course, where it really takes place is in the mind. And it's in the, it's in befuddling minds, to get people to engage in actions that are directly going to harm themselves, that this is all about. I mean, no one sits there. We've got to be caught up, you see, in this hysterical melee. Oh, the Russians are this and the Ukrainians that. But from a, you know, if I didn't know anything much about it, I would simply look at it and say, okay, well, there's the Ukraine right next to Russia. But they don't like the idea of armies building up there and nuclear weapons pointed at them. In pretty much the same way that America was a bit cross when this started to happen in Cuba. Now, it's a slightly different situation, as Miss Lily was telling me about the other day, somebody that I know. But the principle's the same. You don't like the idea of a foreign power having lots of weapons on your doorstep. I think that's understandable, frankly. It's just a little bit too close for comfort. You just think, well, if some nutcase gets in charge, they might just press a button or think they can get away with it, because that's the real problem, isn't it? People wage war because they think they're going to win. That's one thing. Or they wage it because they have no other choice. which is a defensive thing, which is, of course, the worst situation to be in, because usually you start off on the back foot and you're going back from the minute it starts. But you may feel that you have no other option because, you know, the idea of enduring life under the enemy is so appalling that you'd rather die. So people will fight for that. But, yeah, I think the Northwoods thing is very telling. I haven't thought about it for a long time, but I did read it, you know. And the whole – what's that about? It's about psychological warfare more than anything else. It's just about – you know, getting the mark to be bemused. And when you are bemused, it's very difficult to make sound decisions. Just as I would suggest, it's very difficult for me, certainly, to make sound decisions. If I say to myself, well, the mainstream media can be trusted on this. You made a point, I think, a bit earlier. The stuff that's not in it is the stuff to look at. There are experts in this field, people who are very knowledgeable about it in a real way, who, of course, are disregarded. So we must, I think, that, you know, one of the basic rules is to use the media to your advantage by saying, basically, broadly speaking, the people that they're not featuring who know about this stuff, those are obviously the people I need to go to, the ones that they're silenced, because, you know, obviously I know that they're going to blow their trumpets every day, what, beating the war drum right now. But there are people out there that that don't want to beat that war drum, you know. And we must hunt those people out who may know something a little bit better. But I it would be very unwise, this is all I can say, for anything to kick off. But what they're doing, I mean, psychologically, they're softening the people up, you know. Oh, well, I suppose we ought to have a war. That'll be coming around about 18 months' time. They'll know how long it takes before people just get worn down by it. So we're at war right now, you know, the media's at war with us all day long, buggers.
Well, Paul, one of the things that I truly enjoy about every conversation we have is you, cause me to think. And, you know, most people
I'm
would
sorry
rather...
to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that.
Most people would rather
mean, it's
do
Friday
anything.
Afternoon here. I'm supposed to be having a large gin and tonic, you know, and just relaxing. But no, I have to spend my time with you talking about Russia and the Ukraine. No, it's great. So I'm sorry. I'm just teasing a little bit.
You
must forgive me.
Oh, you would be better off with the gin and tonic, I believe.
That's coming up. Don't worry.
One of the things that I think of so often in this respect, and especially when you were mentioning this, I know absolutely that you're familiar with the Nuremberg trials of 1945.
Yes.
And the chief prosecutor, if you will, of the panel was one Supreme Court justice named Robert Jackson.
Yeah.
And I've read over this on multiple occasions, wrote an article about it about 15 years ago. But it always amazed me that Robert Jackson was absolutely insistent against all kinds of pressure. But he was absolutely insistent that the number one charge against the Nazi leadership was not crimes against humanity, but provoking a non-defensive war or aggressive war. That was the number one charge against the Germans, and that was, of course, for the 1939 invasion of Poland, which has been so misrepresented it's unreal. But here we have a period history. Go ahead, sir.
That trial, the whole thing with Nuremberg, you see, I just don't think you can have one. I mean, they did have one. And I won't be able to agree with Jackson at all, you see. So, you know, I just think it's bunk. The whole thing's nonsense. What it is, what that was, is that's a hostile theater environment to yet again cement a part of a false narrative, which is just banging on and on and on. And so they have this ridiculous situation where they prosecute the other side for being naughty and for apparently starting a war. Well, they didn't start it. And, you know, they were encircled. They were ganged upon, just as they're trying to do it with Russia now.
Exactly.
it's the same tactic over and over again. Literally, court historian history is a joke. It's a joke. And of course, you said you had some quotes the other day, and they were kindly sent on to me in one of our groups, you know, and they're a good collection. I've got most of those, but they're a really goodly collection because, you know, when, and this is in any field, so we are talking about the field of the lawyers and some of the generals involved in that conflict back then. When they get old and they're out of the limelight, and there's only a few years left in their life, and no one's going to come along and threaten to chop their legs off because it's just not worth it anymore. You find that they start to spit truth out, you know, all over the place. They just can't help it. It's almost like they're absolving themselves of all the ridiculously silly things, sometimes that they've been misled to do, and so on and so forth. And one of them, which is, I can't remember who it is. I haven't got it in front of me, so I'm not even going to look because I'm just going to mangle it. It's more fun this way. But I think it's relatively recent. Was it Baker, your foreign secretary, or whatever he's called? You know,
James Baker.
Yeah, him. He was talking about the demonization of Hitler. And you see, so the whole story cranks up in the 30s. Ooh, he's so evil and naughty and all that kind of stuff, right? Terrible, terrible. And because it'd been built up to be about this comic book fight, literally, it's never been let go of to this day. And Baker was making this point. We invested so much money in actually doing that way, we can't let it go. You've got to keep propagating it. It's complete bunk. It's total bunk, the whole thing. What's going on now? Putin is now becoming evil because the newspapers say so. I don't think so. It's nonsense. But you see, let's go back to what you just said. If they keep on running the same play and people keep on swallowing it down and going dopey and running into a brick wall, they're going to keep doing it. Well, this is a really sobering period that we've been in for many reasons, not only with this conflict, Michael, but also the thing on the home front for the last 2 years with this COVID thing, right? And I've said from the beginning with regards to that, because it's the underlying thought patterns that we're after. It's not, yeah, they're taking different forms, but basically we are in conflict all the time. And we go, why? Life does not need to be like this. Well, somebody wants it that way. And I would say that there's always been a virus in place, and it's a mind virus. That's the real problem. People can't think straight. And it makes it seriously, seriously difficult to create peace or sense in the world. I quite like Putin. I don't know everything about him, although there's some very interesting, his background's very interesting. I don't know him. Don't know the guy. I've never been out for a drink with him. I don't speak Russian. It's unlikely that I'll ever meet him or really get to know him well in this lifetime. But from a distance, and you look at what he's done for his people, he's actually giving the Russian people their pride back. I'm really pleased for them. Because you look at that and you go, over here it's tinged with a sort of sadness. And I suspect possibly for yourself as well, because we as a people used to be like that. But apparently that's wrong. You see, you're not supposed to do that because you're only half a breath away from becoming a white supremacist. Oh, okay then. That's obviously, you know, a terrible, terrible thing because somebody in a newspaper has said it for the last 50 years or something, you know, and yet no one examines the thought. So we're coming back to this point again. If you're going to swallow down lies without knowing that they're lies, your life becomes very, very tricky. Now, I think we're better at detecting it now than we've ever been. And I think more people are detecting it quicker. So there's a lot of space for hope. I'm not a hoping sort of guy, so it's not the right thing. Let me rephrase that. I think the situations are very encouraging. I think our situation is encouraging, and it may, I think, Michael, in the front of our eyes, look worse. There's so much stuff that they're throwing at us, right? What else is coming up? And of course, the other backdrop that's worth remembering is their agendas. There's Agenda 2021 or whatever it is, and Agenda 2030. And they love their agendas, don't they, and their plans. And we're all supposed to love and be impressed by their plans as well, even though their plans are, you know, I don't know what to say, really. If they were on a piece of paper, I wouldn't wipe my backside on them. Let's put it that way. We have to endure these conceited, inbred idiots. Very bright, very sharp, but not here for the rest of us, just here for themselves, the miserable wretches. And, so there we are. I'm not really answering your questions. I'm pushing it all over the place. My apologies, but it's just one thing leads to another. So,
no, I think that's great, Paul. And the reason I brought up Robert Jackson's assessment was not to give any credence to the Nuremberg trials, which were a soap opera of the day, but to point out that the American public has become so hypocritical that they will embrace the things in 1945 we hanged people for doing. And that was my point, is that, my government, and then here again, I'm going to use the my and the we pronouns, but we accept things from our government that we would never accept from another government doing the same thing. And that, to me, is a form of mental illness. And I believe
I don't think you're alone in that. As a nation, I don't think you're alone in that.
Oh, no. I believe the mental illness has been brought on and propagated by two sources, and that would be the media, which I referred to 15 years ago as the lobotomy box, and the U.S. education system, which is completely Marxist.
Yes, it is. It is. I think, you know, the signs are, of course, that we're kind of in a weaning off process. I would suggest that you probably weaned yourself off of their manure a long time ago. I feel as though I did most of that quite some time ago. But we know people that are still sort of connected, as it were, at the teat to the government trough in all sorts of ways. And I'm not saying that I'm still not. There are all sorts of little precious things and rhythms in your civilization that compel you to, at the time, you have to make a decision about going along with certain things, which you know fundamentally are not right. This happens all the time, unfortunately. But, you know, better to sort of, you know, agree a little bit today and live tomorrow and think about it differently and come at it a different way. But really, we are at war with our governments. But it's dressed up so nicely because they use the word we all the time, you see. We, don't they? And everybody goes, oh, yeah, it's all those. We're all in it together. This is my prime minister. I go, it's not mine. I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? None of these people are mine. They don't represent my interests at all. They've got nothing. This is your local representative. No, he isn't.
Well, Paul, you mentioned something, if I may. Pardon me. You mentioned Putin, and you and I both previously have agreed that I would take Putin over any American politician that I'm aware of at this present time. But here is, I think, a very valid point. We say we don't know Putin, and we don't. But we also have little or no knowledge of the people that we call ours or my. And do we know any more about Putin than we do about Biden or Harris or Trump or anyone else? Do we really know? Or is it just this possessive pronoun thing of because they're mine, they're good?
I think it's the latter. Yeah, on the unconscious level, you know. There's a reason why we operate as a herd or as a group is because it works to do that. If you didn't do that in the past and you were kicked out of the village, you'd be eaten by a bear within inside 3 days or whatever was roaming around out there. It was not good. So this instinct to get along with people inside your own family, of course, we know people inside families that literally have a lot of problems, which I always find rather unsettling, but it does occur. This way of accommodating and dealing with one another, of course, is the bread and butter of life. It's absolutely key. And so, you know, government has set itself up almost as like these great foster parents. I'm really benign. We really love you, you know, and you can trust us to manage your affairs on your behalf. We'll do it well, honestly, but we might end up with very large houses in the country and things and stuff. But, you know, this is just a byproduct of things. So there's a distance. There's literally a communications gap. There certainly is here. I suspect, between the people and their supposed representatives. I mean, the people in political power, the ones that are bringing about or are exacerbating this situation in the Ukraine, to just go back to this, are effectively, they're weird as communicators. There's another word, but they're dissimulators. As I said earlier, you know, they use language not to reveal their intentions, but to disguise them. All the time. This is going on continually. People have been listening to it for so long they've become, you get hypnotized to it. You literally run out of the sort of willpower to even muster a sort of verbal retort. That's what happens. People just go, oh, I can't be bothered with that. And of course, what's that old thing that the problem about not getting involved in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. And, or something like that. I'm kind of mullering that one, but that's definitely the case. So it's right at this level, right at the base level of communication where everything starts to go askew very quickly. Because people say, oh, we're having a communication. I mean, I don't hear any communication in the Houses of Parliament. Any. Right? And what I mean by that is there's no conciliatory recognition or grace or signaling by any of the listeners that they've actually understood what the other person said. And it works both ways. Everybody's grandstanding. They all think they're there to make some great speech. They're all wretched, nearly all of them, because they're not working as a team. And these are the people that are in charge of our nations. This type of personality is in charge of the nations because we are burdened with this thing called democracy, which if it was done in its probably close to its essence, would be probably the least worst solution, maybe. I don't know. But all that happens to it is that it decays, and we've lived through the period of it decaying at an ever greater and rapid speed, and it's really at a super state of decay now. You know, we all feel that. So you look at Russia, that's going the opposite direction, like you were saying, to go back to your ship's analogy, and you go, I won't mind getting on that ship. You see, it's not actually about where you are, I think. It's about what direction you're going in. And we're not going in the right one. We're still not going in the right one. Oh, the West is rich. It's got all this stuff. It won't be much longer if we carry on like this, as everybody can see.
Oh, wow. Well, Paul, we're about exhausted this first hour.
I'm exhausted. I need a gin, mate.
Well, You have about a 4-minute window here to jump on that and to partake.
You mean I can drink three?
Yes, sir. You may drink three, and I promise when you come back on the second hour, I will not have anyone here to ambush you.
That's okay. I think, isn't the golden rule, never mix booze with broadcasting? It's something like that.
Well, it doesn't work for me.
It doesn't work for me either, so I won't be doing it. I'm just winding everybody up, including myself, but there we go, yeah.
Well, I tell you, this has been a scintillating conversation. How many people can you actually sit down with and talk about such things? Well, there's the music. We'll be back on the flip side. Thanks, folks.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's hyper thinking. Welcome to the crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday, for free association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener-supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the fourth day of February in 2022. And I just wanted to tell the folks that I am so appreciative that Paul English has agreed to come on and talk with us today, and that, you know, I kept asking him on multiple occasions to come and join us on Sunday night, which he has done. And then, you know, I began to think that, and I think Paul may have even mentioned it, when he comes on the program on Sunday night, which is a very comfortable 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. for me, it happens to be an 11 p.m. to a 1 a.m. Stretch for him. So I was leaning on his tolerance a little much there.
Terrible person, you know. Yeah, terrible.
I'm not. I started to tell a lie and say I was trying to reform. But anyway, Paul, I just so much appreciate you coming on, and thank you for that. And
it's good to be here. Now this is a good time for me. It's like a really nice end to the week. Nice, what a terrible word that is. But it's 5 to 7 o'clock. I'm like on drive time here with you in the UK, so it's good. And you know, it's not finishing at 1 o'clock that's the problem, Michael. It's that afterwards I'm so revved up I don't get to sleep till 3 o'clock, because you know you start. Yeah, you know what it's like. You have to come down. You sort of, your mind's been whirring away and doing things. And every time I did a late show, I was terrible the day afterwards because I didn't get to sleep till like 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and I have to be up at 7. I thought, this is not working. It's just not. This is not good. You know,
well,
because I'm not a spring chicken anymore, or chicken even.
I certainly understand that, and I know in our communications on Telegram, I think it was probably a few weeks back. I was posting something at what for me was like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and you asked me if I ever slept.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And do you? You never answered it. You just avoided that. You don't sleep, do you? You're one of those odd people. Is that right? Is that what's going on?
Well, I'm an odd person. I'm not sure about the sleep part, but I'm an odd person. But, Paul, you indicated that you may have, as we used to refer to in the intelligence community, some inside skinny on Mr. Putin.
Well, this is something that might stretch your little brain until it snaps, right? But I've had this website. I'll send the link afterwards.
Please,
I might have mentioned these, actually, in conversations that we've had. I'm going to read out the title. This started getting published, I believe, online in 2006. In fact, I'm looking at the first post. Wednesday, the 27th of December, 2006. So this is a little old. And it's a very bizarre series of websites that one would have thought should have been taken down when you go through a lot of it, which I did probably 10 or 12 years ago when they first came out. But I've never lost the bookmark. This one is called Richard Tomlinson and the Russians. Okay. I don't know if Richard Tomlinson means anything much to you, but he was an MI5 or MI6 guy. The subhead here reads, an unofficial biography of an ex-MI6 officer, that's Tomlinson, who is currently engaged in a battle with British intelligence in order to stop a campaign of harassment against him. Mr. Tomlinson is a Royal Arch Freemason. In the past, he was on friendly terms with two former Director Generals of MI5, Stella Rimington and Eliza Manningham Buller, and MI6, a man called John Scarlett. Whilst on their way up the career ladder, Mr. Tomlinson was trained as an MI6 Illuminati mind control programmer. Okay?
Ooh.
Now, I'll just to give you a background to these sites, because they're all linked, they're extremely odd. There's basically, I'm just looking here, there's one article on the entire site that went up on that's all there is, about one or two articles, okay? And let's just see how many comments there are on this article, because this is very, and then I'll read you the key bit about, what's his name? How many comments have we got here? I wonder if they're all listed. They're not. There's thousands. You're getting literally sort of thousands of comments on these things. And then you'll get a link to another blog. And it's very strange stuff. This is really, really strange stuff. I'm just trying to find out when the, 638 comments on this one. Okay. Now, the bit I wanted to read you was this. This is, they're talking about a training, that took place. Let me, PowerGen. Now, PowerGen is in a place called Solihull, which is right in the middle of England. And this took place in 1979. So Tomlinson was about 19 years of age at the time. And it was in 1979 here that Tomlinson was first shown a passport photograph of Vladimir Putin, right? By the way, this is to be taken with several pinches of salt, although it's very well written. There's a lot of intelligence, and it might even be a kind of psyop running this that way and the other, you see. They talk about Poland in 1993. Let me just read you this bit. Part three, 1993, Poland. Vladimir Putin had lost his job as KGB controller of the Stasi in East Berlin. There was a famine in St. Petersburg, and the KGB owed their employees several months' salary. Whole families were starving in the cities, foodstuffs had been held up in the ports, and Vladimir Putin's own family was no exception to this rule. So this is 3 years after the walls come down and everything's in a mess. John Scarlett, MI6 Moscow station, made a deal with Mr. Putin in Poland. They knew each other relatively well, dating back to 1979 to this training in Solihull and to a place called Ein Kerem in Jerusalem, and both were Royal Arch Freemasons. And the blog, I won't go through the whole thing, but what it talks about is the fact that they were going to get rid of him. They were going to get rid of it. Putin was to be used for a certain purpose, then they were quite happy to get rid of him, even though they were Royal Arch Freemasons, which is a branch of Freemasonry over here. He was to be used for a certain task, and then they were going to get rid of him, but he kind of outmaneuvered them. So the point I wanted to sort of bring up was this, and I think this applies to many figures in history because it's difficult for us to always know, is I think many of these figures that we see have been trained through these channels. In America, it's absolutely the case. Over here, it's absolutely the case. These high-level Freemasonic orders, you know, we've got the Fabian Society over here, which maybe don't go into the espionage stuff as much. I don't really know. You've got the Pilgrim Society. You've got all of these different clubs. But Freemasonry is a big clue here. So what's the observation? The observation is that Putin was initially trained as a British agent under Royal Arch Freemasonry starting in 1979. But by the time we get to 1993, some 14 years later, things had changed considerably, and he was now deemed to be an enemy or okay for liquidation. And, of course, he didn't. That's not what happened at all. Anyway, it's a very interesting – I can't cover it all in just one little soundbite, but what I'm saying is that there's a lot to his past and to his connections yet again with the same old brood of vipers that you would expect. And yet, one of the observations I've made, or I think it takes the case, is that, you know, these dogs that are trained by their handlers can sometimes turn out to be smarter than their handlers and do turn around and bite them big time and cause a massive problem. I think Stalin was one. I think Hitler was one as well, to a degree. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Hitler certainly had connections. He spent some time over here in Britain, about 1910. But that doesn't concern me overly, in the sense that, as I said, many of these things turn back and bite their handlers. So it's not all, you know, it's not all plain sailing for the bad guys, as it were. So it's a very interesting series of sites. And it links through as well to some very famous people over here, media people now, who are all killers, assassins in MI6 and Royal Arch Freemasonry. And, of course, they then come from the intelligence services and end up in the media, which, of course, is you've had that over there in your neck of the woods for a long time with Mockingbird, haven't you?
Oh, very
Getting
much
their
so.
Agents, yeah, into high places. So this is horrific things in this blog, horrific. I mean, it's not for the squeamish. There's some terrible, terrible things. And most of the comments are coming in from people who had been trained through these circuits and had rebelled against it. And we're talking about the mindset of the people at the top of this, that we are the people that are going to rule the world. I mean, these people really do exist, as if it needs ruling. It just, oh, it's got to be ruled. Well, you'd just be peaceable and it'd be all right. But there you go. I just thought I'd throw that in. I know there's not a lot of substance to what I've said, but I'll send you the link. It'll keep you there for a few years reading all the blogs that are connected to it.
Oh, thanks so much for that, Paul. I had a former No Such Agency colleague tell me a few years back that Putin's mother quite possibly may have been Christian. Have you ever heard any links to that?
Yes, I have. There's ambivalence about him, isn't there?
Yeah, and I heard, pardon me, sir, but what I heard was that she actually had Putin baptized against his father's knowledge, had him baptized as a Christian, and that might have been the reason that once Putin took over in Russia, he immediately gave the people back their churches, which had been seized under previous administrations, including the church property. Do you have any thoughts or connections on that?
Yeah, I mean, I like that narrative. That doesn't mean it's true, does it? But I like it. I want to buy into that one. I'd heard that his grandma was Jewish. He certainly got connections into the Jewish community, and they've had influence with him. Or have they? You see, I don't know. I'm not in their coffee drinking circle and what's going on. And whatever he is, he's not stupid. Of course, I mean, in terms of the machinations of political discourse and everything, he's obviously competent. And he's obviously commanding the respect of his ministers because he's been there a long time and the Russian people love him. And as you rightly say, you know, do we go by their fruits? Shall ye know them? The church has been reinvigorated under him. And as I was mentioning earlier, the education system now is being re-imbued with Christian ethics all the way through it. It's taking a Christian structure through the education system. And of course, so everything he's doing in this regard is running counter to the so-called rotten global liberal progressive narrative. He's against that. They don't allow gays to parade up and down in Russia. So no sodomite parades. So, you know, it's the kind of place I want to live. Seriously, I want to live there. But I'm not Russian. I can't speak Russian. I speak Russian as well as you do, Michael. So,
oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's okay. So things are pretty bad. I'm not going to get on too long. I can say borscht, nyet, and da, and that's about it. And also, one thing about Russian, I'm going to be silly now. To me, the language always sounds as though they're sucking air in, as though they're speaking backwards. You know those records? It's all about... It always sounds like that to me, which is a rather pathetic observation, but there you go. But I think there's a lot of, as I said, I have to say that I don't know all these things. I've read a lot of stories this way and that about him. You end up with a sort of ambivalent view. But if we look at what's occurring now, is that a good thing for the people of Russia? From the reports I read, if they're true, yes, if they are true. Do I think he's a menace to his people? He's less of a menace than any other leader I can think of. I mean, you know, he's the least worst one. This is the only way you can really phrase it. Or is this some great big plot, Michael, where what they do is they make it go more and more Christian so that they can crush it and finally destroy the last embers of connectivity that we as a people might have to that? You don't know. I don't know. I just know that they think deep and at lots of levels of plotting. And we're all supposed to go along with it. But for now, he has reinvigorated the nation. And it is a nation. It's more of a nation than any other because the Russians are in charge of it. And, of course, globalists don't like that too much, I don't think.
pardon me. Are you at all familiar with the Athabascan language of Alaska through that era and down through into the American Indian tribes of the Southwest?
I'm not, no.
Well, the Navajo and the Apache, their language seems to be very much different, and it has a lot of correlation with the people of Alaska and what have you. And the reason I ask you that is, did you find any similarities between the Russian language and the Athabascan language?
I don't know, Michael. I don't know. I don't really know the answer. I don't even know what to say to that as a question. I'm so ignorant of both of them, really, in terms of the way
well,
that they
I, did, I, don't know. I didn't. I certainly didn't mean to put you on the spot, sir, but...
Well, you did. I just don't know. It's
well,
okay.
Well, okay. Then give me 2 points. But the thing I was thinking about was having listened and having actually lived on the Navajo Indian Reservation and having listened to their language, and I immediately thought about that when you made the comment about they seem to be intaking air in their conversation instead of exhaling in the conversation. And I found that to be true among the Apache and the Navajo as well.
That's interesting. Well, of course, isn't the ancient story, as it were, that there was a point where there was a connectivity between, was it the Bering Straits or whatever, there was a land or an ice shelf, and that effectively the root people of the Red Indians of America are effectively, their ancestors would be the Mongolians of the East, in terms of what is now referred to as Russia, and that they moved across, and that this is part of it. So maybe there's just some kind of habitual air sucking type language.
Well,
that comes from that. I don't know. I'm really grasping at very, very thin straws here, and it's probably rather pointless. But yeah, I don't think all Russians sound like that. It's just I've got this thing about it's. Languages are interesting to hear them. I don't really want to speak them all. Russian is not, I don't find, I like the sound of German because my mum did for some strange reason. She
right.
said, oh, everybody says it's a harsh language. She said, but I quite like it. And, you know, so if your mum likes a thing when you're a little boy, you might pay attention. You just do, don't you? And
you better pay attention.
Yeah. You better. Otherwise, yeah, no supper tonight, lad. And things like that. So, yeah. but yes, absolutely. Russian. Okay, well, who knows? Who knows? Maybe the Russian and the Navajo are joined at the hip. I don't know. Well,
there are some very interesting points there that you made about Putin. And of course, we know, again, not to be redundant, but we know as much about Putin as we do about anybody in the American government in actuality, except the one thing that I was also thinking of as you spoke is if you have ever had the misfortune of being in the bowels of this beast, as I was in the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s, there is nothing about anything they ever say that you can ever trust.
No. I mean, because, ultimately, why would there be?
Well, their foundation. Sorry, sir. Go ahead.
I'm talking a bit too much. I was just thinking that these are mature institutions that are just steeped in intrigue. And so it is, you know, I don't envy you your time there, whatever it was like. I'm sure you had good moments or, you know, hopefully you had good coffee breaks and good sandwiches from time to time and things like that. But the idea of being sort of immersed in a culture that's based on deceit is not something that's very good. You could see for your health. I mean, it's just, and as a people, we don't respond well to that. And yet, of course, it's a weapon that's brought to bear all the time. We're told that we're naive, you know, the blue-eyed naive. That's what it's all about, isn't it? The blue-eyed people. And yet naivety I find very attractive in a way, but you can't abuse it. Unfortunately, the enemies do abuse it. And, of course, you have to wise up very quickly because you're going to end up in deep trouble if you don't pay attention. But, yeah, I just think these are very mature cultures, you know, in these spy agencies. And they just think in a kind of useless way. It seems joyless to me, but that's what they've become. You know, they come from a long line of people. I mean, over here it's that way. People in the intelligence agencies now, their father was and their grandfather and so on and so forth. And he was Colonel this in 1842 and this, that, and the other. It goes all the way back to blah, 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 blah. And we're always in the officer class, you know, and this, that, and the other. And okay, great, fine. And they're not stupid people. I'm not saying that at all. But they've developed a kind of sort of very calloused and cold, virtually zero connection with the actual people of the land has disappeared. So I don't include them as part of my we, you see. they're not in it because, as you were saying earlier, the governments of countries do worse things to their own people than most enemies would and do. Certainly not in the past, of course. You get completely slaughtered. But now it is slightly different.
Well, the one thing that I learned during my tenure, Paul, was that the very essence of government is the lie. And then when I watched over a period of time and had a pretty good window of reference, when I saw how actively they pursue the sociopaths in society to bring them in, because nothing could be better in the CIA, which we call the Christians in Action, NSA, DIA, any of those other, you know, you could say the same thing about Mossad, I'm sure, or MI5 or MI6. The ideal recruit for that type of work is the person who doesn't have a conscience.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, they get them all the time. I mean, this really is the problem, is that, you know, we've got, are we able to detect psychopaths, sociopaths quickly enough to not be defeated by them or outmaneuvered or deceived by them? And you have to say historically, no, we're not.
Well, hell, Paul, and, we vote for them by the millions.
I know. Although, please don't include me. I've never voted in my life. It's a filthy habit. But I think that's kind of the issue, you know, and it just won't be resolved overnight because it's down to individual aptitude or the lack thereof, or the good or bad guidance you're given in your formative years. And so it's difficult. It's a struggle. and people have to make the best of their own lot. But the idea of these sorts of people, maybe these people have always been in charge. I mean, there's a book, what's his name? Is it Lobajewski? I'm mispronouncing it, called Ponerology. You ever come across that word? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard of this word Ponerology? It's not, you know, at first I thought it's the study of ponies, but it's not. It's the study of systemic evil. P-O-N-E-R-O-L-O-G-Y. Wow. And there's a book.
Yeah. I'm not familiar. Educate me, sir.
Well, I haven't read the whole book because it's a pretty dry sort of academic treatise. And I sort of thought, yeah, sociopaths, that's fine. I've got to get on. I'm okay with that. But he talks about this, the rise of organized evil. And it's not sort of as if they sit down and write a book about it. It's just that they detect one another very quickly. And they tend to come together and work in their own interests. And therefore, you end up with these people that we would call ruthless, who do not care about the welfare of others. It's not even that they're low on that front. It's that they literally, I think they've done scans on them. You know, this is the whole psychopathic thing. There's literally no response by them to the plight of others, which I think to most people is just an appalling condition to be in. You think that this is that learning to deal with these feelings and do the right actions sometimes, and obviously the wrong ones at others as you learn, is a key part of living, to feel warmth and concern for others is the whole purpose of it in many ways, or it's certainly a key part of it. Therefore, to live without that is very strange. And I think, you know, like the technocrats, the ones that are making all these great pronunciations about how we're going to transform society and you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. These sorts of, you know, they're basically psychopathic, sociopathic people that we cannot communicate with. And what I mean by that is that, you know, even if we were sat in a room with them and an audience were hearing us make the most incredibly sensible and cogent arguments or propositions about how things ought to be organized, it wouldn't make any difference to them because they can't hear us. They're never going to hear us. They will pretend to hear us. They will pretend and make promises of things that they're going to do to us. And they'll do it so well. They'll be dressed in very good suits when they do it. And they'll arrive in the best cars and they'll have the best aftershave on or whatever it is that they do. And everything will be about making an impression to dull our senses. And say, well, this is a man of substance, but basically they're in it to create some kind of ridiculous. They never ask, as you see. We're not actually ever consulted sensibly. We're never asked. So I say, if you don't ask, the answer is no on everything. If you ask me, I'll consider it. But you've never asked me, you know, you never asked me that we should go to war in 1939. I mean, I wasn't alive then, but so we can't. Until you ask me, right, you don't get my consent. And you better be quick about it and keep it simple because we haven't got forever. And I'm not interested in all your complexity. But, of course, all of these communication diseases are built up around government structures. You know, the question, is it possible to understand how things are going to develop by listening to politicians? I think we all really know the answer to that.
You know,
these are not
the
people you go to. You don't go to those people. They're all part of the ponerology tree. They're part of a ever-growing systemic evil, whether they know it or not, because it's got all the hallmarks of that, a disregard for the welfare of others being right at the heart of it.
Most interesting. Paul, I kind of threw a ball in your court before we went to the top of the hour, and I know and I ask, would you be willing to talk about your current venture? I know that Dave's illness sets you back quite a bit. Are you comfortable discussing some of that at this point?
Sure, yeah. Well, I can give you an update on Dave. So for people who don't know, Dave Gahary is a publisher, and I've known Dave for about two years now, but really quite closely for the last year and a half. And he's just a top bloke and works hard, and we're often talking about just getting things done. Anyway, he's recovering well. And yesterday, so your timing's good to bring this up, actually. Yesterday, he actually called me, and also I was on a call with him, and the author Tom Goodrich, who's the author of Hellstorm. And we used to have a call a couple of times a week for until Dave becoming ill, discussing things. And he's recovering well. And he's still not fully there, still a little short of breath. But he's on less and less supportive oxygen each day. And the really good point that he made, it's all going in the right direction. So that's the most important thing, you know. He's in a better place today than he was a week ago. And his weight's going back on and his attitude's there, which was, which is key, you know, because he's strong in that way. And so he's going through it. But what he was saying was that his lungs are recovering. He's actually recovering. He's getting better. He said, so the effects of this are not permanent.
Fantastic.
It is. Yeah, I just said, you know, and we were basically, it was almost like not gallows humor, but really the thing was, we didn't think we'd ever be doing this with you again. You know, once we did, they put you on a ventilator. What are you supposed to think?
How many times?
I know. So he knew it too. You know, he said, yeah, you kind of, that was the logical thing to think, because it is the logical thing to think. So he, you know, and I said, oh, great. Well, we've got our own in-house Lazarus now. So this has got to be a good sign, you know, so. He's fulfilling that role, but yeah, no, the project I was, well, that's now back on the table because of his recovery, was a radio project to put a new station together on the net. And I'm not going to give the name today because I don't want people searching for it just yet, but I'm fingers crossed this month, February, it'll go. It was due to go in September. So we've made a few more adjustments and a couple of things I've got to do, and you'll be familiar with some of the people that'll be around it to start off with. But, the idea was simply to create a platform for free speech, which of course by definition means that it's going to be in parts intermittently and probably for long stretches of time, very politically incorrect. Because that's the only, it's got to have that there. We can't avoid it. If the truth takes you there, so be it. We're not here to sort of follow the diktats of people who say we're going to make all the rules up. That's not the idea of it. And so what we've done is we've scoured around for lots of podcasts and things like that that we thought could be featured and put into this place. So there will be some live programming, not a great deal to start off with, but that's not too much of a concern because I think it could build up quite quickly. And the idea is to put together something that's got a good sound. So we're hoping it's going to sound well. And be organized well and pull in some of these shows. We've had a schedule running for quite some time now, and some of them are great and some of them are rather sort of tame, you see. But I actually quite like that. It throws up all these sorts of thoughts about what a schedule's like. I mean, do you have everybody talking intently, say, about the Ukraine-Russia thing? Do you want that? You don't. I mean, there's a room for silliness. There really is. There's a room for songs. There's room for poetry. There's, you know, in our store cupboard as a people, there's a lot. And it's not been taken out for a walk for a long time, it seems to me. We are overwhelmed with the cultural bilge that emanates from the main media organizations. It's vacuous, pointless nonsense, most of it. Worse than that, of course, it's actually psychological warfare on our people, on the Western Christian people, is absolutely that. I mean, the whole of the COVID thing is about the genocide of the white people. It's not about anything else. It's self-evidently about that, because that's where all the trouble's taking place. And all these traitors, these Freemasonic retards at the top of the government structures are happy to go along with this. Well, good luck to you, because I'm glad I'm not in your shoes. I don't mean in terms of me providing a threat to them. Not in this realm. They are holding sway. Good luck. But later on, things are not going to go so well, I suspect. So we all have to stay on the right side of what's good, it seems to me. And anyway, so this, we have a lot of literature to talk about. There's things other than just politics, which I want to talk about. There's play to be had. We could even, if we were able to do it technically, organize some politically incorrect quiz shows. That could be fun, couldn't it? So listen, I'm just making a sort of pitch here. I don't know. Maybe we'll not get any of these things done because there might be hurdles a bit too big, but, I want something, it's broad. The idea is broad. There'll be certain people saying certain things I expect at one part of the week, which will be completely contradicted and opposed by people at another part of the week. That's fine. I have no problem with that, because if you can discuss points at which you're at odds in good humor. And of course, you can't always. People can't always do that. But that's always an interesting dynamic. You're wrong about this. I mean, people don't really do that, do they, anymore? But and we're hoping to get people to be able to call in. Technically, that's all in place. So, you know, we could do phone-ins and stuff like that and try and make it a nice place. I should stop using the word nice. It doesn't mean anything, does it? A sound place, haha, literally, for show hosts and producers so that it works well. And I'm not saying that other people are not doing well. I'm just giving it a go. I 8 years ago, I assisted Eli to put Eurofolk Radio together. That has its own particular niche, as it were, that it does things. This is to try and broaden, provide a slightly wider umbrella. And it's even now, it's got things on it that I don't like on the schedule. And I put them there on the schedule. But there, you know, when we get more people coming in, sifting this and hopefully adding a little bit of input and polish to it, then it's going to end up as a different creature, which is fine by me. That's what I really want it to do. So, and we've got some ads. I'd like to run old 1950s radio ads, if you've got any in your back pocket, Michael. I want to advertise tires from the 1950s.
Oh, wow.
What, you're thinking I'm mad, but what it is that these things evoke, in the sound of them, the way they're put together, they evoke a feeling about how things were better. I think that feeling's worth evoking. I do. I think the idea of good, happy, healthy families is something that we're not talking about enough because, you know, I'm not involved in researching all this stuff to be an expert or to know a great deal about it. It's just that it seems to me the times that we live in require some of us to do this with the goal of unpicking it in such a way that we can wound it and then really wound it and wound it so that it never gets up again. And we've got to understand, you know, where our weaknesses are, because that, although I know that there's several forms that the enemy take, and one of the forms they take, of course, is to suppress free speech. And without that, we're lost. I mean, you know, we wouldn't even have the opportunity to argue with one another. That's no good. So if our words and our thoughts and our feelings and literally the sound of us is not being heard, we've got a big problem, because that's where we live. We live in that space. We live in this space of the ideas that we as a people have generated. We're bound up with them, whether you like it or not. They are us. We are our ancestors to a great degree, good and bad. And that's fine by me, because that's the cards I got dealt. So, you know, my view is deal with it. So if we can create a space in which we can maybe emphasize a few of those things, good. Either that, or this is just a load of sort of artistic guff and waffle I'm putting out. But we will see. There's a lot of hard work involved, but at least I know how much work is involved because I've done it for a long time. So I've got no delusions about what it will take. It's taking a lot at the moment, and it will continue to do that because we're trying to, you know, I would like to see something that I could participate with and make as good as we can. And of course, my last point, Dave being a publisher, there's a lot of books to promote, and we need to promote things back to one another a bit more. I don't mean sort of pointless, vacuous salesmanship. I mean, I think that many of the, you know, you and I are talking about things, much of which, nearly all of which, I learned from reading and hopping from one thing to another and connecting this to that. And I'm not alone in that, and neither are you. And so we're doing these things. And so access to the information and pointing others in hopefully the right directions is always useful. I mean, it's very difficult because people say, what should I read? And I go, you know, I don't know. You've got to really drive yourself. Well, what is it? You know, as you know, my thing was I started reading books about banking, which honestly, really, when I started doing it, Michael, was just bizarre to me. Honestly, would you like to read about the history of the Bank of England? Would I? I said, surprising myself with my own enthusiasm for this, you know. And I go, what's happened to me? You know, I used to play music and be in a band and do things. Then, no, this.
I want to know about banking.
I want to know about banking, isn't it? Banking's groovy. I love it. I love the smell of banking. And show me a good old banker any day, and I want to join banking clubs. Yeah, it's just mad, really. So,
Paul,
everybody's got their different route into it, haven't they? You know, yours is from personal experience, it seems, Michael. You've right, directly been in the pit of the beast, you know.
How much gin and tonic was involved in that banking decision?
No. No, and I didn't even drink gin back then, really. And I don't drink, I'm just sort of hamming it up. You know, you have to create a character when you're behind the microphone a little bit, you know. So.
Absolutely. You mentioned pitching some books, and you mentioned earlier Tom's work. Would you kind of tell our audience a little bit about Hellstorm?
Yes. In fact, I'm on with Tom next Saturday on radio again. I've just been so busy. It's a bit like, it was so quiet for 4 months, and then it's like a bus comes along every day. It's lovely, actually. Next Saturday, Michael, we're on Blood River with Eddie, the host there, which is on Liberty News Radio. I think about 10 o'clock my time, so it's 5 o'clock Eastern next Saturday. So Tom will be joining me, and we'll be, the reason we're doing it is February the 12th, very close to Dresden Day, which was 13th, 14th, and 15th.
Right.
They did the bombing on Valentine's Day because, you know, they're so cute. And so we will be going over that. I think this is the third year that we've done it, and it's good. And so a couple of hours, I'm quite looking forward to that as well, because it's obviously something close. Anyway, I didn't know Tom. I just knew of his book. We're talking 2013. So I think the book came out about 2009 or 10 in paperback. So it'd been around a few years. I was aware of it. And I don't know quite how I got all of his email, but I contacted him. And even then was working on sort of radio and ideas at the time in a quiet way, just building up, because I had other things that I was doing as well. And I ordered my book, my copy of Hellstorm, directly from him, and he shipped it from wherever he was at the time. And he put a lovely little note that he'd written on the inside, which is very much a sign of him as a man. He's a very considerate and even-tempered sort of guy, and I get on with him tremendously. Just everything about him is right up my street, as they say. So we struck up a relationship, and a few years went by. And for people who've not read Hellstorm, it is a kind of well, for me, all I can say is for me, it was a visceral experience reading the book. It was extremely. It's a terrible book, right? It's probably the most brilliant, terrible book you'll ever read, because it's about terrible, horrible things. And the power of the book is that it's from much of it is from firsthand accounts of people that were involved primarily in the onslaught in the East during World War II and of the complete destruction of Germany. But of course, it talks about the destruction of Germany from 1944 to 1947, because what most people are not aware is that more Germans died in that period just after the war than did during it, because the intention was to destroy them, to destroy the Germans utterly. That's the whole key part of this, and you will be quite convinced of that if you get round to reading Hellstorm, which I suggest people do. Anyway, a couple of years back, is it 2018 or something? Time flies, maybe 19. I, on a whim, one morning, I just contacted him. I said, Tom, I think Hellstorm needs to be recorded as an audio book, and I'd like to do it.
And you did.
If you'd like to.
Very yeah. Well.
Yeah, and he said, oh, that's interesting. He said, because I'll probably be saying this next Saturday, so if you're hearing me saying this, sorry, there's only so many ways of telling the same anecdote. And, apparently, wherever he was, I think he was in Northern Europe at the time, he said, somebody just came up and asked me this morning about that. Was there an audiobook? He said, so I think it's a good sign. So I'm going to say, he said, yes. So I said, look, I'll do a couple of chapters, send them to you. And if they meet with your approval, I'll do the rest of the book. So I did. And that ended up as about 14-hour reading. And I've recorded lots of other things since then, but not a formal book. That's kind of how I developed my relationship with Tom. And with that subject matter, and how it just illustrates the fact, I would suggest, that the backstory that we have for ourselves as a people is wrong. We're not telling the right story about ourselves at all. We're telling a story that's been imposed upon us by an enemy, which is not us. And this is key, because we are the people of the story. More than anything else, we learn best through stories. We're the people of the fairy tale. We're the people of the ancient traditions. They're imbued in our blood. You can feel it. It's part of us. And so when we've been running around, particularly since 1945, telling lies to ourselves, which is a story concocted by those very forces that brought that conflict about and who are not us, but are in charge of the way that the power centers of our nations operate, we are involved in a sort of process of self-hypnosis. We're hypnotizing ourselves with lies, which we've voluntarily sort of been duped into or entered into. And so if you read Hellstorm, it's like a bomb going off, because it's visceral and it's foul and it's wretched and it's tragic and it's evil on every page. And you will find out what was really going on. And so we live in reverso world. There was a genocide attempt taking place in World War II. There absolutely was. But it wasn't by the Germans. It was to the Germans.
To the Germans. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Paul, would you be so kind as to send me a link to that program next week with you and Tom on the Dresden deal? Because I certainly would like to publish that on my channels.
Sure. Yeah. Yep, I'll send you after the show. I'll send you a link. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I'll send you that.
Well, thank you for that.
It's always. It seems to me that it's ground worth revisiting repeatedly, not to sort of indulge in the perversity of it all, because it is, but because it's almost like it epitomized the madness that we've fallen into. We destroyed ourselves. I've often said this to people where they go, you know. Oh, well, we won the war.
You know? Yeah, okay.
Like, oh, really? Could you please point out to me what it is that we actually won? You know, like you and me today. What are we the great winners of? Huh?
Yeah, where's the
same
trophy?
Foul, you know, and Churchill, of course, over here. But you didn't get me started on Churchill, but it doesn't take much to get me started on Churchill. I'm not a fan, Michael. That's an understatement.
Really?
Right? I'm really, really not a fan. And
I'm surprised.
I'm the most not a fan of Churchill person you could ever meet, because the backstory yet again that we get from the media pundits is complete garbage. That is total garbage. It's utter garbage that this country wanted to have a war with us and he saved us from National Socialist Germany. It's retarded. Is that story, but they get away with it because they owned all the newspapers, all the publishing houses, all the intellectuals in the publishing houses writing this crap. And it's not black and white. I'm not saying by any means that the Germans were angels and saints and this and that. It's warfare. What do you expect? But when you actually look at the base of it, the preponderance is who was the least worst participant? It's the Germans by 1,000,000,000 country miles. They were attacked. Not the other way around. And all these other things are, you know, yeah, I'm sure the duplicity and this foulness taking place on all sides. But to listen to us, we're all noble all the time and lovely. Well, this is, I have a friend here whose father is still alive, who was in World War II. I haven't seen him for a couple of years. And his father's in really good health, and he's about 98 now, but still sharp as they come. He was involved in actions which he's ashamed of to this day at Arnhem and around that. They were told to just literally slaughter these Germans that they trapped. They didn't take them as prisoners or anything. And he feels, you know, you can, when people talk about these things over and over, they never make films about that, do they, Michael? They don't make films about that. We've got to tell the story given to us. So I would like, you know, going back to the radio thing, but this is nothing original, for us to have more spaces where we tell our story. As it is, unbridled, warts and all, the lot. It's the only way we're going to tidy this place up, because it's a right
Absolutely.
Mess.
Absolutely. And Paul, I will tell the listeners, for those of you who have not read or heard Hellstorm, let me tell you, that's not a book for the mentally squeamish or the people who have a real problem with the truth. I've always found it unusual in history that I could, or an entity can come over and kill your family and slaughter your family, and they're okay. But if you go back and for revenge or whatever, slaughter theirs, you're the bad guy in history forever. Yeah. I've always had a problem understanding that concept, because that has to be, from what position can you ever accept such as that? It's just a loss for me.
Yeah, we come back to these sort of basic human behavioral traits of wanting to go along to get along at school and absorbing the history or wherever you got it first. And the teacher seems like a nice guy, and he probably thinks he's telling you the truth. He probably does, you know. So you've had all these sort of false echo chambers down through time. It's this ability to really ask questions. And it's not what most people tend to think it is, or it's certainly, I would suggest, not what's presented to us in public discourse. I've rarely ever heard a question, if ever, in the Houses of Parliament. They're not questions that they're asking. That's not what they're doing at all. The golden rule is you never ask a question that you don't know the answer to, or it's the other way around. It's a setup. A question is really that thing that you used to ask. And hopefully you still do. And I try my best to ask it. And I'm sure we attain this. When you're young and your heart's open and you absolutely do not know and you don't care what's going to come back in the answer, that's not your concern. It's the only way that you receive the truth. It's the only way you can get it. Because if you've got these preconceived ideas, oh, it's like this. Well, okay, glass half full type guy, or glass completely full. How are we going to get some stuff in there? So, you know, you acquire these things as you move through life, and then you have to keep jettisoning them all. They're appropriate at the time, but you go, oh, my understanding of history at 14 is not quite what I would like it to be. That's no wonder I thought that at 14. But most people don't correct, do they? Or it seems that a lot of people will not correct. They don't keep asking questions, and yet it's a source of infinite wisdom to ask a question in that way. And of course, what it then does, it seems to me, Michael, is it gives you a sound base of ideas. And one thing that no one can stop is an idea. That's why this is all being conducted in the realm of words, because that's the form through which ideas are expressed. And so, you know that the definition of words are being mangled all around us all the time, and intentionally, and the language is to deceive us and to obscure their true meaning. And this is the task at hand, because it's like the code in our operating system has got multiple viruses in it. And no wonder the output is nothing like what you told it on the input, because it's going through all this mayhem where the code's mangled up. Mm. So, it's a test. Paul, so you have to stay awake on it, obviously.
Well, Paul, one of the things that has always troubled me in my study of 40-plus year study of history is one of the things that I was taught very early on is never be too timid to ask a question whose answer might make you terribly uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I like that, but I suspect that I've avoided asking questions that would,
we all
that would
have.
Make me feel. I know. I mean, it's like, where's your threshold? And all I can say is, I hope mine's higher tomorrow than it was today. That's all. I just keep pushing it. And know that I'm not going to get all the way there, but it's this thing about direction. You go, we're pushing in the right direction. We don't know quite what we're going to get, but we're heading in the right way. Whereas at the moment, you know, we're like on the train track. It kind of looks okay, but it's going towards the ravine. It's going to that bridge that's not there. You go, I don't think this is a good idea, guys. I think we need to really stop this thing and turn it around. This is not good. But it's so comfortable in here, and the food's nice, and I sleep in a good bed. Okay, I understand. Yeah, and, you know, the scenery's lovely. Yeah. Okay, but it's going to go over a cliff. Oh, it won't. Okay. Bye.
What was it Emma Goldman said about Americans? Americans truly do not want to be free. They just want to be comfortable.
I'm afraid that that's true. I know freedom's thrown around a lot as a thing, and it's not – I'm not against it, but for me, it's not right at the top of the list in terms of – I think it's the product of something. I think a condition of freedom or an experience of it or a sense of true well-being comes when you are at ease, when you're at peace, when you're calm, when your brain, possibly for those few minutes, hours, possibly even days, months, if you're that so gifted, operates at a higher level, is attuned to higher thoughts. One gets in touch with beauty or the concept of it at a much higher level. And to bring those conditions around for us blood and bone creatures, we have to first have justice. We have to have a basis of law. And it is written on the inside of us, but of course many people use their brains to override that, so it causes a problem. But that's where it's at for me. I think freedom comes about when other things are in place, these things that you have to be pragmatically responsible for, and then suddenly maybe you have a day. I mean, I love the freedom of being five, Michael, of course, no responsibilities in life, and just running around the garden, throwing worms at one another or firing the hosepipe at one another. That was great. But, you know, things Absolutely. Do change, don't they? They do change.
Oh, I also just thought of something. Most of the time when I watch TV lately, it's either BritBox or Acorn. And I was very much pleased a month or so ago to see a BBC program. And of course, it was like a detective program, but they actually did a whole program on Operation Keelhaul. And I thought to myself when I watched that, how refreshing it would be if someone in America would have the courage to do the same thing.
Well, I suspect they do. I suspect maybe these films do exist, you know, but our marketing is kind of shut down. It's this thing about creating a grapevine, you know, something strong. We've got more tools than we've ever had, and it's stronger than it's ever been. And there's still a long way to go. Because we are looking for a critical mass, basically. That's what we're looking for, a kind of tipping point. And we must keep building towards that. But, you know, the main thing is that white people have got to start batting for themselves.
Amen.
They just don't bat. They don't go to bat for themselves. And it's a big problem, really big.
Absolutely. Sir, I tell you what, I wish we had another couple of hours for this. I'm not sure you would be
agreeable. You're keeping me away from the gin.
We're almost out of time, and you're keeping me away from the American honey.
Good.
We're almost out of time, and I cannot thank you enough, sir, for coming on. It has been a delightful exchange, and I appreciate you, and good luck on your venture, sir.
I enjoyed it a lot, Mike. It's been great. Thank you. Thanks for the invite. It was lovely.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. And take care there, sir. And, well, let's see. We may have about a minute left. Anyway, we'll hear the music very soon. But just to thank everyone to tune in Sunday for my program on to Addicted to Your Own Destruction. And we're going to talk about the prisoner of war missing in action fiasco of American history. And there it is, folks. Thanks very much for joining in, and we will talk to you soon. Have a great weekend, Paul.
You too, Michael. I'll try and tune in and get to sleep easily on Sunday evening.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero five one seven three.
We talk about decentralization and back.